Grenade, episode 359. I'm your host, Hector. And on this episode, I welcome guests David Hopkins and Austin Wilson. For years, I'd listened to David and Austin on Hideous Energy, a comic book podcast, my favorite podcast ever. They've since ended that show and moved on to other projects. Austin, a published writer, launched Ledger, which is a podcast where he interviews other published writers of all mediums. And David, who since I've been following him, has broken into the comic book industry as a letterer, designer, co-hosts the horror podcast Eerie International. Both Eerie International, along with Ledger, are great shows you should take a listen to. So on this particular episode of Mind Grenade, I split up the show into two parts. First part, we get into some music discussion and some creating comics talk. And for my benefit, I'm going to correct myself right here up front. During the discussion on creating comics, I used the term rhythm to describe when a comic book creating team is in sync. I think a better term would have been harmony. So I kind of mix up my music metaphors in creating comics. Instead of rhythm, I meant harmony, but I think the guys got what I was getting at. And then in the second half of the podcast, we get into the reason I brought the guys on in the first place, which was the fact that we're all three huge David Fincher fans. David Fincher, the director of Seven, Fight Club, Gone Girl, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He recently released the film The Killer, streaming on Netflix. I think that dropped around the holidays. I think it was in December, the beginning of December. And we get into our feelings on that film. And again, I'm going to correct myself up front in this intro. When we were talking The Killer, we were describing the movie as boring, but not in a negative way. I think a more apt term to describe the film is quiet rather than boring. A movie like Oppenheimer or Darkest Hour, movies like those are quiet, still compelling, but for whatever reason, we just kept using the term boring. And to be fair, it was probably me that started using that word to describe this film. But despite my terminology, you'll be able to tell from our conversation that we really did enjoy this film. And up front too, spoiler alert, we do touch on a couple of plot points. So if you don't want the film ruined for you, just here's your warning. Though apparently I had a lot to unpack on this intro, it seems like. But, you know, I'll have links and relevant info in the show notes to this episode. So thanks for tuning in and enjoy this episode with David and Austin. So, you know, guys, it's been a while since we've talked, and I've listened to you guys on Hideous Energy, obviously, over the years, and Eerie, and Ledger, and I feel like I think I can guess the answer to this question, or part of the answer to the question I'm going to present to you guys, but it's music related, and I feel like since I've listened to you guys over the years, that when you give me the answer, I'm going to be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. So. When I have musicians on the podcast, like local musicians or whatnot, I'm proud of this question. I'll ask them favorite musician or band before that broke before you were born and after. So, David, you'll have two answers, and Austin, you'll have two answers for this question. So, for me to answer this question is okay. So, favorite musician or band before I was born. So, a band that broke and got big before I was born that I grew to love, my favorite band, and then since you were born. So, for example, my favorite band that was big before I was born was Pink Floyd. Usually the answer for the second one is a band that you really, like, got you when you were a teenager, which for me is Radiohead, and you guys already know that. I can guess David's favorite when he was a teenager. I could be wrong, but I'm guessing Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, you're right, because Pretty Hate Machine came out the year I was born, so whether they broke with that or not, I'd still be
okay,
right after.
Damn, okay.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, that'd be my after. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think my before one now. Austin probably knows this.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, my after.
Oh, I know Austin's too.
Oh, wow.
What is it?
your before has got to be Bowie.
I would literally the entire time Hector was talking, I was like, it's Bowie. Fuck, is it Bruce Springsteen? Is
oh,
it Bowie?
Shit. Yeah, Springsteen too, yeah.
I don't know that I could pick. Like, I don't know. It would be impossible for me to be like, I choose one over the other.
And I've heard you talk about both over the years, yeah.
They both mean so much to mm-hmm. me, and I listen to both of them so regularly, and it would be impossible. So, like, I have to be a dick face and be like, it's a tie.
Yeah, yeah. For before.
I can't choose between those.
Yeah.
And then after I was born, it's Josh Ritter.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I would have guessed that. Okay.
Yeah, I think
I think it would have come into more focus even more so post Hideous Energy, okay. probably too. Okay. Like you've liked him since I've met you, but I feel like that's only grown more and more in the past mm-hmm. handful
yeah,
of years.
Yeah. I've been listening to him since 2007, 2008 maybe. I was listening to a guy named Josh Rouse. Who I was really obsessed with, and I was working at a Blockbuster Video that'll give you some some time travel to tell you where I was, literally at a Blockbuster Video. Anyway, I was talking to this girl I was working with, and she was like, "What do you listen to?" And I told her I really like Josh Rouse, and she said, "If you'd like Josh Rouse, you'll really like Josh Ritter." And I was like, "Okay." So I started listening to Josh Ritter a little bit on the way home, and I was like, "Yeah, I don't know, it's okay." And I've now seen him in concert 3 times.
Wow.
he's my guy. He is a novelist. He's the best.
Man, I'm struggling for my one before. Maybe Austin would know.
Probably.
Yeah, any metal there? I know, because you kind of go into, you get into some metal there. So like Black Sabbath or anything like that, David?
I thought of Black Sabbath, but I feel like I really, really, really love a couple of Black Sabbath albums, and I haven't listened to all their stuff. That's the problem with a lot of these, is I'm like, oh, Fleetwood Mac, but I'm like, I have a massive career. I love Rumors. Like, I should I count that as my, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot that are right on the edge, like Pixies and Smashing Pumpkins, yeah. and that would have been, like, breaking when I would have been, you know, 2 or 3 years old or whatever.
The Pixies,
but
the Pixies I got into after they had broken up. So, and I don't think it had the movie, Pump Up the Volume has like a cover of
fuck yeah,
Wave of Mutilation, which is a fucking awesome song. And, and then of course Fight Club, which, might lead us into why we're here today. The director of Fight Club. The Pixies, when that hit me, boy, did I get obsessed with the Pixies. Like, the songwriting, of course, and plus indie music's, that's the shit for me. That's what I love the most out of all the genres. And those guys are like indie rock gods, but the very Lennon and McCartney-esque kind of combo of Kim Deal and Frank Black, like, you know,
oh, yeah.
like apart. They're you know, they're really good, but together it's something special that like wouldn't
yeah.
you know. And so I got into them when they were broken up in the, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s, and then they got back together. I know Kim Deal's not with them anymore. Kim Deal's fucking awesome. Like, I fucking love Kim Deal.
Yeah,
I love the Breeder.
Breeders are great.
Yeah. You know, I was having a conversation with my brother the other day. Some Nine Inch Nails came on, and bow down for the one you serve. It was playing, and I was like, you know what? Like, I was there for the 90s. Like, you know, there's bands that kind of exemplify, like, they great examples of what it feels like to. There's bands that transport you to that era. But like, for me, Nine Inch Nails is the one where I listened to it. I was like, God damn, that's what it feels like to be in the 90s, is to listen to old Nine Inch Nails. But the Breeders, Cannonball.
That song is great.
That, like, and so there's good. An effect that gets played in the background, like, during that song, that sounds like the internet being born. Yes.
Wheel, wheel, wheel.
But there's like, Like, it sounds like back in the day when the dial-up shit, like, it's part of the song in the background embedded. And I'm like, this song is so 90s, you can hear the internet being born in it. Like, the Pixies. Oh, and then I got this, when they got back together with Kim Deal, the whole band, I got to see them live to perform Doolittle from beginning to end, which Doolittle was my introduction to, I'd heard Where's My Mind and Wave of Mutilation before from, you know, movie soundtracks and stuff. But then, my 19th birthday, I went out to a record shop, CD shop or whatever, and I was like, I want to try something new. So I gave Doolittle a shot, and then it was, happily ever after. It's one of my favorite bands of all time. Doolittle's one of those albums where you can listen to from beginning to end, I feel. And it's just quick kind of indie rock songs. But I got to see them live about, when was it, like 2010? And they played the entire album from beginning to end.
Awesome.
It was awesome. With Kim Deal and everything, yeah. But Pixies, man, I fucking love that band. So what do you think, David?
I just thought of another one. I thought of another possibility, but I don't know. Like, did they ever break back? They probably, I don't know. I don't know. I'll let you guys decide.
Yeah.
But I forgot his name. He comes weird, Austin. The Cure. No.
But that can still apply,
Henry
probably.
Rollins' boyfriend.
Who was it? Oh, Danzig.
Danzig.
He comes weird.
Danzig, Glenn Danzig era Misfits. I'm a huge, huge fan at this point of those albums. I like actually some of the stuff after, but I can listen to those day long.
That's probably what I would say for you.
Yeah, but I don't know enough about, did they break back then? Were they popular then?
No.
I didn't think so. So, I mean, it might be technically not not an answer that works.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
I think with Misfits, it's
a band I used to hate too.
Huh.
I think breaking for them is very different than literally any of the other bands that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're releasing stuff on smaller record labels. They're sort of on the ground for a while.
Yeah.
They become bigger much later on.
I guess I should also explain, as in this dude, Open for the AAS, it was like a local guy, and he was doing acoustic covers of Misfit songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was part of the, he was fine, he was good, but I think that was part of the problem, was I was like, the fuck is this? There to see Karen O wrap a string of Christmas lights around her head and be weird. So like this dude up on the stage didn't click. But then I think it was, what song was it now? Anyway, yeah, I think after I got into metal and after I got into horror, obviously there were two natural sort of connections that that made it easier.
Yeah.
So I appreciate it a lot more then.
Yeah. And then Austin, you were saying Josh Ritter at first, you were like, it just wasn't connecting. And then the next thing you know, you're just obsessed with it.
Yeah, I started listening to Josh Rouse a ton because I had watched Almost Famous. And Josh Rouse has a song on the Almost Famous soundtrack. I think, I don't think he has a song on the Almost Famous soundtrack, but Cameron Crowe on one of the DVDs that I had did a deep dive into songs that he was really in love with and that he wished more people would hear. And he was talking about how this one guy specifically was going to blow up, and his name was Josh Rouse. And I was like, okay, I don't know that guy. And he has an album called 1972 that's sort of a throwback album. Like, it's almost written and recorded in a way to sound like it's an album from that decade. And the title track, 1972, is a great song. So I fell in love with all of his stuff and was watching all of his stuff come out as it did. And I was super excited. I wanted to go see him in concert. And I had basically just fallen in love with his music at the exact moment that he moved to Spain and then never performed in the United States again.
Damn.
Until, fast forward, maybe 10 to 12 years after that, he did a concert with Josh Ritter.
Okay.
which I couldn't go see, but just that it existed was pretty crazy. And then, yeah, so what ended up happening, they're both really great writers. Mm-hmm. I would say Rouse is probably a better singer as far as his overall skill level. Ritter is a singer-songwriter, like 100% through and writes some of my favorite lyrics that I've ever heard. And like I mentioned earlier, he's also a novelist. He's written two novels. And he's a painter, and he's kind of a bastard, obviously, because he's great at whatever he does.
Yeah, right.
But I adore his stuff so much, and I got to see him, I think I said three times earlier. I think that's a lie. I've only seen him twice. But
yeah,
the second time I saw him, I was in Michigan, and it was in a theater inside of a, I think it was a church, maybe.
Yeah.
I was probably the youngest guy there as a 39-year-old.
Yeah.
and this was back when I still had a Twitter account. I posted a picture of the stage, and I was like, I forget what I said. I was like, I'm sitting waiting for Josh Ritter, super pumped. And I tagged him, and he responded to the tweet.
Wow.
He was like, yeah. Oh, dang, that place looks cool. So I tweeted back at him and told him it was about to get way cooler in about 30 minutes whenever he was going to show up. But I've deleted my Twitter account since then. Lost my interaction with my best friend, Josh Ritter.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, I can tell that, you know, everybody's love-hate relationship with social media is kind of, you know, leading us away or towards other social media. The way I've come to terms with social media is that I'm only on Twitter one day of the week, or I try to. Twitter Tuesdays, and then it's just free for all. I can just go on there and I feel I can do it guilt free. And then Facebook, which I like Facebook less than I like Twitter. It's all fucking trash, but Facebook, I'm only on there Fridays. I'll cheat every once in a while, depending on what's going on. But like, I tried it cause it's fucking the dumpster fire all over.
When I deleted my Twitter account, I had convinced myself that it was more helpful to my career.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah.
And after I got off of it, I was like, I literally was wasting time. All I was doing.
Yeah.
Literally. And deleting it, not just deleting my accounts, but deleting it from my phone, like not going to it anymore, has really, really helped me in ways that I wasn't expecting, and kind of also am pissed off to know that I had let it take over aspects of my day.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a Blue Sky account
mm-hmm.
when it hit, and I eventually got an invite to it.
Yeah.
And it was weird after having no Twitter and then getting a Blue Sky account.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you know what? I don't really care anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think I need this. So now I use my Blue Sky account.
Yeah.
Kind of for one thing only, which is to see if Guillermo del Toro has posted.
Yeah. It's funny. It's one of those decisions where you're like, man, I should have done this years ago.
Yeah. I did get to meet cool people, and I did get to talk to people and have a lot of fun on it. And it was a big deal for a while. And I did get some stuff published because I met, you know, editors or publishers or other writers and stuff. But eventually it becomes a minor aspect of it.
Right. Right. Austin with Ledger, I was kind of peeking at the website, and like one of the posts, something you posted on here, and it's just like the title that really just like, I was like, oh man, that's a writer right there. And it's just the title, dude. It says Solidifying Imagination with Illustration. I was like, fuck, that's beautiful.
Oh.
I was like, that's a writer.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. That was, I was working on a project, and I got Luca Visayo to do some sketches of characters that I had in mind to help me.
Yes. And he's kind of
work
artist,
through the process of getting that stuff put together. And then that project fell apart and I didn't finish it and went on to something else, which is you know, that's that happens every once in a while. But
you guys did a comic book podcast for years, and I got a lot out of it, and just the different perspectives on the medium and everything else. And I love fucking comics. I mean, and you, it's just a sentiment you guys kind of would speak on Hideous Energy, which is the marriage of the art and the writing. Like, you know, I tell people, I was like, yeah, you know, like Kevin Smith and Stephen King wrote comics, but initially they overwrite because they're novelists. But it's supposed to be like, it's supposed to be a marriage of the two. It's like two different languages that you combine to make like an Uber language, like a, you know, the art is supposed to, I think of like, Usagi Yojimbo with, Stan Sakai. His stuff is so deceptively simple, but you read enough of it and you're like, no, there's a visual, he's writing, but the art by itself is also a visual language.
Yeah.
And,
visual storytelling.
Visual, yeah.
Yeah. I think probably you said it really well there. When you start out, you overwrite, and comics that I wrote when I was younger were filled with words. And it's not that that's inherently bad, but you have to have an artist and a letterer and an entire team that's willing to make the comic the thing it needs to be. And the more stuff that I've written, I wrote a comic, a short comic, like 4 pages, maybe 6 pages, last month. Hmm. And my scripts have less and less dialogue in them than they did even 3 years ago, when I got to work with artists like Seth Haney and Luca Visayo, and these artists that I can come to and we can create the vision together. And it's almost like when you're younger, at least for me, when I was a younger writer starting out, you want to prove to people that you're writing the comic.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the comic, writing is not a thing that you can see immediately. You have to experience it. You see the art. The story is there as a thing that you're going to be taking in internally, but also externally, because the art's there, obviously. But you can't just look at a comic and be like, oh yeah, Austin definitely wrote it, unless my name's on the cover and all this other shit.
Right.
So you want to do the dance and have these characters, you know, give these big sweeping speeches and say things they don't need to say, especially if somebody, you know, who's a good artist shows up and illustrates it in a way where David and I, when we work together, I have probably said this on our show in the past or at some other point, but I encourage every writer to work very closely with whomever is lettering the book. If it's a cartoonist and they're doing it themselves, or if it's a letterer and a designer, the amount of times that David has come to me and been like, this isn't going to fit in this page as well as it could, or this doesn't work that well because this image is here and this word is here. I've edited my shit a lot, and he doesn't do this with every writer, for any letterers or writers who may be listening. This is because David's my brother, essentially. So don't get any ideas as far as how lettering usually works. But if you work with a letterer closely and start to understand how a page is laid out and the kinds of challenges that go into making a page and then an entire book, you should know going into your draft that you need to use as few words as possible.
Yeah.
And as a writer, there was a time when I was like, well, why would you tell me that? I'm a writer. Like, I'm going to use words, but like, okay, then write prose.
Yeah.
If you want to write a shitload of words, you're writing in the wrong medium. Because comics needs as few as words as possible so that the art and the words can work together in harmony.
But it can have a ton of words in the script. Like, it can have a ton of... Sure. You can,
obviously, not that you're not saying that, but, like, I think, to your guys' point, that's where the collaboration and the art comes into place, because
and it depends on the artist you're working with too. I mean, Austin has worked with artists where he's just kind of said like, look, this, it needs to be this. That's all I'm going to tell. Like, I know you're going to do this better than I'm going to try to explain it. Like, here's what I need. And it's not quite Marvel method, 'cause he's got, you know, his stuff written out, but then there's other times where like, yeah, you need something specific and you can, I mean, everybody's seen Alan Moore's, script for Watchmen. What is it? The first like panels, like three pages or something.
The,
like,
yeah,
that's obviously an crazy but exaggeration.
Yeah, close, yes.
Well, the first panel is, a full page.
Yeah.
And for any writers who might be listening, or any like letterers or comic book artists who are starting out, get your hands on The Powers script book by Brian Michael Bendis. Mm-hmm. That book changed my life, because if you look at the finished book, it's Michael Avon Oeming on art, and Bendis is writing it. Sometimes his panel descriptions are literally like he's walking up the stairs. That's the panel description. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to write crazy sweeping panel descriptions if you're working with someone that has the chops and has the same sort of understanding as you do what needs to be shown. You just have to figure that relationship out before you jump into writing and doing an entire book. That's the other thing. If anyone's listening, start small. Mm-hmm. Do not start with a full issue or even a graphic novel.
Yeah.
You will shoot yourself in the foot. Start small.
I remember bringing this question up to, and we were getting kind of long on here, so our David Fincher The Killer review is going to have to just be a minute long, but and it's completely my fault, so I apologize, guys.
No, man, this is great. We love talking to you.
So I brought this up because I'll have my theories and shit, and then I'll present them to people, and I feel like sometimes they think that I've just like I'm stubborn and I'm gonna, that's my idea, but usually when I throw out theories, and it's that I'm going out on a limb and either I'm going to go further or I'm hoping you guys will pull me back a little bit. So this is one that I presented to a couple of my Mind Grenade co-hosts. We work at a pharmacy. I've since resigned from that pharmacy. But at the time, I was thinking about comic books and the production of them compared to and I wasn't trying to say that one was better than the other. I was just like, it's just a thought experiment, like just to see where it could go. So with a novel, which I respect prose, I mean, fuck, I don't have to stick up for novels like Shakespeare and everything else. Yeah, right?
This might be a controversial stance, but I'm a fan of books.
Yes, yes, no. Yeah, so solely, I'm not trying to get them to say which one's better. This isn't about what's better or worse. I'm saying like, production wise, a prose novel, you need the writer, the editor,
they do proofreaders.
Yeah,
we'll hit it, which is, you know, an offshoot of letter or of editing. Mm-hmm. But
well, there's also different kinds of editing. You can do line editing, which tends to be proofreading as well. You can do story editing. You can do developmental editing.
I think what you're describing would be in one of those situations where it's like an established writer putting out books.
Yeah.
Like at least that's my understanding. Austin can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think then it gets down to, and again, it's similar to comics where like the relationship is working at that point.
Right.
And there's a rhythm and a communication that's happening.
Right.
And then I think that tends to be where you see more of that. I feel like where it's like, basically the writer doing the book, and that's always, it's always portrayed in film and stuff too.
Yeah.
There's always a writer by himself and then an editor calling him wanting pages.
Right.
But
right.
It makes it seem like it's just those two.
What's the end of your comparison though, Hector?
The writer editor, essentially to get a novel done, the average, page count, 500, 800 pages. I'm just throwing numbers at the wall here, but like, and then a comic book, which is usually 22 pages, give or take. It changes over the years, but a comic book, you have the penciler, the illustrator, the inker. A lot of times, I know that's becoming less of a thing. The colorist, the letterer, the editor, I'm leaving. I feel like I'm leaving people out. But so, but then even that, and then with the comic, it's got to be like, for it to be a success, like to turn, you know, to be a good comic, like David was just saying, like there's got to be kind of get the rhythm right, everybody, because with comics, the people I just named off, the colorist, the letterer, the artist, the writer, like even the editor sometimes, those are all art, artistic endeavors by themselves, and then they have to combine like Voltron to yeah. put you know, to have that same vision, and you can tell a good comic from a bad comic when it's not, they're not in rhythm. And so for me, the whole premise to why I'm bringing this up is like, so I remember asking my two co-hosts at work, not on the podcast, I was like, what do you think is more like production heavy, like making 22 pages of a comic with five different people, or
in a month,
or two or three people making a novel that's you know, so it seems like more calories are being burned with a 22 page comic than with a novel. And I guess the quality and the depth of like how, you know, like with comics, you vary between like some just a regular fucking Marvel comic that comes out randomly for an issue of whatever, Thor, but then you got like the high end shit like Watchmen or whatever, that's like more I don't know, like the bar's higher with the creativity on that, but like,
yeah,
I
think it's hard because there are so many caveats for mm-hmm. for when, like, if you're doing a 22 page issue, mm-hmm. I don't think it's even a challenge that putting a novel out is way more production heavy mm-hmm. because the amount of drafts that are being done.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't consider that. Yeah.
And even if you average the average length of a novel, let's say 350, 400 pages, okay. The amount of drafts being done and the amount of edits and changes mm-hmm. Before. But that's the other thing, is where do you start that? Because if I'm doing a 22 page comic and I work for Marvel or I work for DC or Dark Horse or Image or any of those places, how many drafts am I getting to do writing wise before it has to go to print? If I'm somebody like Bendis, mm-hmm. probably not that many drafts because he's been doing it for as long as he has. If it's a book that comes out monthly, I'm probably getting to do two drafts, maybe.
I see.
And what do you think, David?
I mean, I know the answers to some of these questions with.
Oh, no,
but I can't.
Yeah, I'll put
that's,
it.
That's right. That's yeah. I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
I'll put it this way. Comics are way more chaos than people know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my answer to your thing was going to be something Austin and I talk about a lot, which is that it is a fucking miracle that comics get put out every month.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, legitimately, it's a pretty crazy thing, kind of always, just in terms of how they're done, how things come in. Like, that's another reason why it's a tough comparison, too, because it's always different. Like, it's always a sort of different thing. If you can get people that are professional and are on top of it and know what it takes to do it, then yeah, totally feasible. Like, it's mm-hmm. you can do it, but there's so many variables always.
Yeah, right.
So the amount of things that can mess up or can change, or I mean, I know a letterer one time who lettered an entire 2-3 issues for DC, and they ended up completely changing the course of what they were doing, and those were like, okay, let me not even use that example. Let me use one of my own. Lion Forge. I lettered a series for Lion Forge called Excel. I also lettered 6 issues of it with a completely different team oh, wow. that no one has ever seen, because they started making their universe. The writer was the same. But they started making their universe, and then they changed direction before they launched it. There was one, I'm trying to remember the name of the books now. There was one book in there that was an Andrew McLean book that was, you can find like,
I remember that.
Yeah. You can find pages and stuff from it that were previewed out.
that are completely finished issues and no one will ever see them. Like sometimes stuff like that just happens and it's a weird thing. The other aspect of it that's interesting too is like the, you're talking about like the calories burned and all that. Mm-hmm. Like I lettered an issue, an IDW comic today and I don't know, 2 hours maybe. The artist probably spent the entire month drawing it. Mm-hmm. So like there's so many things about it that are different.
That is the part where production for a comic leaps ahead in how long it takes, because I could write a script in a day. That doesn't mean it's going to be good or that it's going to be the thing that goes to print. Mm-hmm. I could write a novel. Let's average out the amount of time it's taken me to write the ones that I've finished and say a year. Mm-hmm. And that's me. Mm-hmm. Some people can do it in 6 months, you know, who knows? Mm-hmm. The difference there though is once it's finished and let's say I did that knowing I had a contract, like I had an agent, I've got a contract in place. The production between putting a book out and putting a comic out, specifically a 22-page comic book. And this is not saying one's better than the other. Right. I know that's not what you meant, Hector, mm-hmm, but right, just like, you know, juxtaposing the two to look at them. Mm-hmm. That book that I wrote and finished and I have a contract for, mm-hmm, might come out a year later.
Right.
That 22-page comic is probably going to get printed in the weekend after everybody finished it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going to be shitting their pants, mm-hmm, to make their print date.
Right.
And I don't think one...
Final order cutoff for Diamond, too. It's another big part, right, of it.
Yeah. And I don't think one necessarily maybe indicates more production stress. Mm-hmm. Well, definitely stress. But just the, like, depth of production. Mm-hmm. Because... you eventually have to stop, like you have to stop writing,
right,
whether it's a comic or a novel. And with comics, there are at least more people involved where there are things that can still be happening right up until the point of it going to print, sometimes literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, the writing aspect of comics too, like to Austin's point earlier, like I would say there are maybe... three to seven writers that I regularly work with, that I will have some form of communication, whether it's something as direct as text, which I have with a few other writers other than Austin too, but maybe more like email. Mm-hmm. That is, and I don't know how many writers I work with, but that is a minuscule fraction.
Yeah, very small.
The vast majority of stuff I'm lettering, they finished their draft months ago and they're on to 15 other things that they've been doing by the time it gets to me. So that also is part of it too. Again, varies. Like the thing I lettered today, like as I was lettering it, I was like, this is the first draft. Mm-hmm. Like this is, there's plenty of panels here that have nothing in them. So I lettered it. That's another reason I was able to letter it quick, but I also know I'm going to turn in this proof. This writer is going to show up and I'm not talking shit about this dude. He's great to work with. Mm-hmm. And anytime that he has, you know, rewrites or whatever else, he pays for them and he makes sure that I'm tracking stuff like that. Like he's awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he probably wrote that, I'm guessing, that first draft a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And now he's moved on to a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
The proof's going to come in and he's going to have another sort of attack at it. Okay, what do we need to do here, here, here? And he's jumping in and then he'll jump out to another thing, mm-hmm, that he did way later. So
yeah, yeah, yeah.
To put that into perspective. Okay, so last month I wrote a short comic. Mm-hmm. I think it was 4 pages in an hour. I wrote 4 pages in an hour. Pretty spare. My wife is going to draw it.
Oh, wow.
So she's... we kind of worked on it together. We did a little bit of layout where I would, you know, do some very rough thumbnails because she's an artist and I'm not. But then 2 days ago, I was working on the thing that I'm writing currently that's prose that I hope it turns out to be a book. I'm just under 10,000 words. Hmm. I wrote about 750 words for the day and it was a good day. I felt like I was walking on sunshine.
Awesome.
I got 750 words. That's not normally how, like, normally I aim for more than that, but just for that day alone, like, that was where my brain was like, you did it. Awesome. Like, you survived. And maybe no one will see that. But it's weird thinking about the ways the production of both have such similarities, but such disparate elements.
Right.
Yeah.
This is kind of why I brought it up, because one of my co-hosts instantly was like, no, of course not. Fucking books, novels. My other co-host, Matt, he was like, no, he's all, you know what? My first instinct is novels, but let me give it more thought. Approaching it and agreeing or leaning more towards that it's nuanced is probably the right, rather than being just like, no, it's novels, or no, of course it's comics.
Well, I think it depends. There are a lot of caveats, but if you have a 400 page prose novel, you're looking at maybe 80,000 words. Getting that in shape point where it tells a coherent story is real fucking hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And 22 pages of a story. There's a lot of moving parts, obviously. I mean, just comparing 22 page issues that come out monthly, even bi-monthly, they move so quickly.
Yeah.
Because they have to.
Right.
A graphic novel, like an original graphic novel, would probably be a little bit more comparable as far as production wise,
right,
to a novel. But there's just so much stuff that can go wrong. Putting longer stories together.
I think making a comic. My dog's gonna be barking in the background. Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah.
I think also to make a comparison to music, since you're a big music guy, I think making a comic's more like a band making a few songs in a month, maybe two, three songs, like, because it's not a long form thing. But it is something that each person's bringing a completely different thing to the table.
Right.
And could the writer of the band go off and write a solo album? Right. Totally. Could everybody could do a longer form thing, but it's a collaboration to make a small piece of something that's a bunch of shit together.
Right. Yeah.
If it works.
Well, even with movies as a comparison, like, if you think about...
I almost said that earlier, too. Yeah, well, it's like, just obviously way bigger.
Well, yeah, but even if you think about small productions, like Evil Dead, the original Evil Dead, or Blair Witch Project, like, a small team, you can't... They're, like, one person can make a thing.
Right.
And maybe that movie is Skinamarink, which I haven't seen, but, like, that scale... affects the production level just by what's possible, because even the most like solitary of art, the second that you want to do anything with it, other people become involved. It's impossible for them not to, because if they don't, the thing you made is in a room and no one interacts with it. Someone else has to come in contact with it at some point, whether they're viewers or production assistants or distribution. Like, someone else comes in and helps, and all of those things affect the amount of time production takes.
When everybody syncs up, you know, like, it's almost like waiting for the stars to align. Wanted to have you guys on was to talk about The Killer, and one of the things about that I wasn't expecting with this new David Fincher movie is that because I knew Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross were going to provide the score, but I didn't realize that the Smiths was going to be such a big part of David Fincher, man, like he has a very specific aesthetic, which I it clicks with me perfectly. Like, so I was so, I was like, oh, fucking sweet, a David Fincher movie. That's because Mank had come out and he's been doing, is it Manhunter, right? Isn't that him on Netflix? But this one specifically, because I understand that Fight Club has, or people can like appreciate that movie for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think people can misinterpret that movie.
Yes, exactly.
In the same way a lot of people misinterpret Rorschach and other stuff like it.
Exactly. So I was really stoked that he was making something more akin to Zodiac or Fight Club. And I love his aesthetic, just like, and his precision. And that he's gonna do, he seems like he's very confident in his direction, and so much so that when he gets an actor like Michael Fassbender, Michael Fassbender is just gonna go, he just trusts the director so much so that he's just gonna go with it. I did find out that the killer was gonna be made, I went and read plenty of the Bond SNA, the French graphic novel, American translated version of it, and I really enjoyed that, but that was one of those series that just kept going and going and going and going, so I didn't completely finish it, but I've read quite a bit of it, and
can't believe you didn't read the newest one, man. It's the best one.
Oh really?
The one.
So oh
no, David I lettered it.
Oh yeah, really?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's good, I don't know, I didn't read it I was lettering it, but yeah, I lettered the newest
one. Wow, I did not know that. That's awesome. Yeah,
well, the interesting thing about that is that it's I was thinking about it earlier when you're talking about collaboration too, because it being a translation job, I interacted with no one. I got the notes from the translator. I cleaned out the text, but they kept the same balloons and no, I had to clean out the sound effects and do those in English too. But other than that, it was just kind of placing text. It was a finished comic almost. Okay. So it was like a translation job.
Yeah. I like the simplicity. I like that they didn't try to make it sexy and cool, the movie. I mean, it is cool because it's David Fincher and Michael Fassbender, but they weren't trying to hip it up by dressing him.
He fucks up the whole movie.
Yes, exactly, from the get-go. So spoilers on the killer. And we're not going to go super deep into it because I don't want to keep you guys too late. But so spoilers for anybody listening to this. And you should watch this movie. I watched it twice just to make sure my original opinion of the movie was as strong as I thought it was, but I did watch it twice. Avoiding the, what everybody's been doing online, which is comparing this movie to David, it's hard to do to compare it to his other movies. But I think on its own, I think it's a very, what grade did I give it? I think I gave it like a B minus or something like that, or maybe a solid B. I'll have to go back and look, but I liked that. They didn't try to hip it up. He again, spoilers, he fucks up at the beginning. He hypes himself up to be like this fucking like high end assassin,
professional, yeah,
like
consistent. Yeah.
But then right away he fucks up. But then it wasn't like I was like, oh, this guy was just talking shit. I believe he is what he was saying. He fucks up. But then the rest of the movie, I think when I watched it the second time, it's him needing to, well, it becomes a revenge thing, of course, but like to recalibrate, maybe, you know, apparently I'm not as good as I thought I was, or I've gotten a little bit lax in my skills. So now I need to recalibrate and I heard somebody compare the main character like David Fincher as a director, where the older you get, you start to get a little rusty and then you just have to kind of prove it to yourself that you are. So I like that aspect of it. I liked that they the little nuanced stuff story wise where, whenever you see him at a kiosk somewhere, the killer, Michael Fassbender, he says the minimum amount, like he's trying to just like, the purpose of him being, he wants to say as incognito as possible.
Not be memorable.
Not be memorable, exactly. So he says the very, like some people when you see him at a kiosk talking to somebody and they're trying to make conversation, he just nods and then walks, you know, gets his ticket and walks away. Just little shit like that.
We've talked about visual storytelling earlier. I saw somebody on TikTok point this out. Actually, I think it was on a podcast, but how all of the shots in the film are on either like a dolly or on a tripod and whatever, mm-hmm. stationary. I mean, it's smooth and consistent. It's not handheld. The moment things fuck up, he switches it to handheld.
Okay.
The cameras. And there's a moment in the movie where they do it in one shot. It's awesome. I think it's right at the beginning of the fight scene that he has with the dude, which is probably one of my favorite scenes of the year.
I agree.
I told Austin when we got out of it, I was like, I've never seen a fight scene that well choreographed. That's that hard to see by design. Like it's not that it's underlit. There's an entire like a making of that Netflix put out on YouTube about that scene. That's awesome. But anyway, in that scene, he's like walking through and then the dude comes out of frame to hit him.
Yes.
And so when that happens, he knocks him out of the frame and then they basically take the camera off and start going handheld right away within the same sort of movement. So stuff like that, I think you're talking earlier about Nolan and Fincher, like these are also dudes that are, and I use that in a gender neutral way, that are just on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're, you know, we're all creative. We're all making stuff. These are guys that are just a place that it's hard to even comprehend the amount of scale and control and detail and everything that's happening.
Didn't we watch, a video, I think it was you and I, David, maybe you sent it to me of, shit, who was it? It might've been Matt Damon. He was on the set of Gone Girl.
Oh yeah.
And another David Fincher movie. They're filming a scene where Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike are in a bookstore and an extra walks by, literally just like walks in the shot that like, as they had planned, this extra walks by and hits a mark. And David Fincher turns to Matt Damon and he's like, "Did you fucking see that?" Like, do you think that's how people walk? Why would they think that that's how someone walks? And he replaced that. He like got someone else to do the walk. And then literally, and it's literally just a person walking by an extra like background. And after the person he got to do it next did it, he turned to Damon and he was like, "That's how you fucking walk." And
I think even he might have mentioned, like, he wasn't an asshole. Like, he wasn't.
No, yeah, right.
Like, but it, yeah, it's that level of. I mean, I think we all have some amount of it in our own individual work too, where it's like you put the amount of work you put into something where if you really think about it, probably no one is going to notice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, with Fincher, with Nolan, with anything else, whether they notice it or not, maybe their subconscious does. Maybe it is another piece of the architecture of this particularly creative thing that you're doing that helps it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a coincidence that they love Kubrick as much as they do.
Yeah, I was thinking, dude, before you, like, I was thinking Kubrick, like, 30 seconds ago from what you guys were saying, David. Yeah, Kubrick for sure.
Yeah. I really like The Killer. David and I talked about it a shitload after we left the theater because I think it hit us weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't hit, like...
Right.
Well, Zodiac, obviously, was one that we brought up a lot.
Right.
Or even
it's kind of boring.
Yeah, 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 like, yeah.
Yeah, not in a bad way.
Exactly. Like, no, yeah.
It's
built in. I rewatched the beginning of it a couple nights ago.
Yeah.
And him literally just sitting and talking in a pretty calming voice, honestly, mm-hmm. about being an assassin and needing to be able to be bored. He literally talks about if you are someone who jiggles your leg, I think is maybe one of the things that he says or something like that you're in the wrong business. Mm-hmm. If this is what you're doing, because he's literally just staring out a window, and those portions of boredom are built into the screenplay and the film in a way that does sort of test. And I think Fincher does this purposely, because you see him light, shoot, and then have sound in certain scenes. In this movie specifically, the fight scene that's almost 100% in shadow. Mm-hmm. And then in The Social Network, that scene where they're in the club screaming at each other to try and be above the audio. And in the special features, he talks about how they very specifically did the audio in post-production so that the audience has to lean forward. Mm-hmm. He wants you to struggle to hear so that you have to lean in,
yeah,
just like the characters are doing in the scene, because it is this dickhead giving these secrets and telling these big things for the characters that they're leaning in because they're life changing. So he wanted to affect that in the audience. I absolutely believe that Fincher was like, we need to represent the boredom,
yeah,
of what it's, yeah, like to sit and stare out of a window. Yeah. For
it's all deliberate.
Hours.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't read all the comics, but the ones I have read, that's part of the comics too.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's in the spirit. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
And they're slow.
Yeah, it usually is, yeah.
They're not action packed like pulpy thriller, you know,
right,
killer going off and just blowing people away. Like it's way more measured, way more deliberate in its pacing.
Yeah.
When they first came out, Austin and I worked at the comic book shop, and I remember at the time our take was probably a lot more cynical.
We were babies about it.
Well, and just kind of being like, this is all style, no substance. Mm-hmm. You know, it's maybe not, that's not even the right comparison, but just beautiful to look at, but not much there for us writing wise. Mm-hmm. And I think the movie honestly helped me, I think, zero in even more with the books and kind of understanding, okay, I need to reframe how I, part of it's the marketing too, which, you know, I can't blame RK or Netflix or whoever's putting out the comics. Mm-hmm. Like, they want to sell the books, so right, they have to market it in a certain way. They're not going to be like, come see one of the slowest movies of the year. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Well, right, I want people to watch it.
I will defend this forever, that the credits of that movie don't match the film. Like,
it was a weird fucking choice.
It's so strange.
The end credits, right? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the opening credits.
The opening credits? I don't remember the opening credits now.
It's
real quick, like, right?
Yeah, these weird, like, quick cut images. And honestly,
they look like a cover of like a legal thriller or something.
Like, seriously, yeah. Well, also the eye lying on its side with the bullet hole,
yeah,
I think is so stupid.
Yeah.
It is the it seriously is the most childish and like college freshman level choice for a film that doesn't have that in it. It's like, well, what if the eye's dead? He's a killer. I get it. But
yeah,
it's just so stupidly unsubtle
that
the film doesn't have those things in it.
Right.
Which is why they stand out to me.
Mm-hmm. The trailer really got me. I watched that trailer. That and it's the Godzilla Minus One trailer I watched over and over and over again before those movies came out. So I could be wrong, but the trailer music did sound very, very Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor, but I could be wrong.
Pretty subdued score for them too.
There
were definitely moments I was tapping my foot or bobbing my head, but mm-hmm, I mean, it was a lot more like tones and textures and stuff.
The Smith stuff. I missed the Smiths growing up, that when they were like a thing, and even Morrissey. But since this movie, and I've tried in the past to be like, oh, I'll give it a try. My favorite music's almost, it's the majority is British, like, you know, Radiohead, Pink Floyd, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin. The Smiths, I was like, why did I, as a blind spot, I'm old enough to have, I could have gotten caught up in that craze. But like, with this movie, I didn't know. The Smiths was going to be an element that was so kind of in the forefront in this movie. But actually, it's not really in the forefront. It's just part of the tapestry, like I took the opportunity to make the playlist of, because he looks at his little iPod or whatever the fuck he's using, and it has the playlist and in order of how it's played in the movie. Because, you know, it'll cut to the next scene, and the next thing you know, he's in his van listening to Girlfriend in a Coma, I think is the name of the song. I forget the names of the songs, but the names of the songs are always kind of like seemed like titles to a novel or something like that, the Smith songs. And because I knew obviously their biggest hit is How Soon Is Now. I had always wanted to try to get into the Smiths, but it never happened. I created the playlist that the Michael Fassbender's character has in this, and I made it on my Spotify, and I've been listening to that more now, and I That's can awesome. Kind of see the appeal now, and it's growing on me. But yeah, man, overall, again, not comparing it to his other movies, not doing that thing that people did with the movie Drive, where people are like, I'm going to sue the makers of this movie Drive with Ryan Gosling because it was supposed to be a Fast and the Furious type movie that was promoted that way. But then it turns out it's a boring ass movie. It's like, I that wasn't me. When I watched Drive, I was open-minded enough. And I don't think I would have gone and watched Drive if I thought it was going to be a Fast and the Furious type movie.
Yeah.
But with this also, like, I think people, and you mentioned it, you guys mentioned it a moment ago about the marketing for The Killer. Like, yes, it is kind of a boring movie, but it kept me, I was compelled the entire way through. And I watched it a second time just to make sure it wasn't like recency bias or just like, not recency bias, but like, that was so excited it was going to be a new David Fincher movie.
First
that,
impression.
Yeah, yeah. So I watched it the second time. I was like, no, I get what he was going for. And I really enjoyed it. The juxtaposition, that awesome fight in the middle of the movie, and then followed by the Tilda Swinton scene.
Yeah,
I found both just as compelling. Like,
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you can have a boring movie and it still be compelling. Yeah. Obviously it's not easy.
Yeah, yeah. Oppenheimer
by design makes something that. Yeah, I mean you can get. But I think I told Austin probably five times in our conversation after the movie, I need to watch it again. Like I could tell it's one of those things where it's like having some sort of expectation, not of quality, but just of like what it is going to be like, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And it not lining up with that, having to go back later and be like, okay, I know what this is now. So yes. let me meet it where it's at, yeah. As opposed to trying to get it to come to where I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, we'll wind down. Thanks guys for being on here. And,
For sure, man. Yeah.
Absolutely. We love coming on and chatting with you.
Yeah. So, like I said, I'll actually do any listeners a favor that are interested, and I'll link my, The Killer, soundtrack onto the show notes on this episode so people can go on there. I did go on to David's Spotify just the other day. And
mine?
Yes.
I've been on Spotify in like 2 years.
Oh, you haven't been on there? Okay.
I had to switch to Apple Music.
Oh, did you? Okay. You have a Spotify playlist on there that cracked me up.
I know which one it is.
Christian song, and I can anything on this episode you guys want me to take out, I'll take out. But it says Christian songs that don't make me want to piss blood. And then it looks like it's got fucking 25, 30 songs on it or something like this.
I grew up with a very, my dad was a pastor, parents were missionaries. So I was very entrenched in contemporary Christian music, culture, CCM as it's called. Right. And this would have been like pre Michael W. Smith and like worship music, where he sort of took it, and it's completely changed. So back then it was like DC Talk, Newsboys, Audio Adrenaline, like all these bands. And there's some of them that now still, whether not the message necessarily, but just the songs themselves.
Yeah.
I was talking to a girl on Tinder one time, and she found that, and she was like a pretty devout Christian, and luckily she thought it was very funny. But
yeah.
I that was when I was reminded that it was a public playlist that you can see the name of.
The Christianity, I know plenty of Christians that do a lot of good things, but Christianity as a whole, any big group, any monolithic, any kind of like the government, corporations, big giant churches and stuff like that. I'm like, there's plenty of awful shit that come from big groups that come together. And but
yeah,
the individual
sucks. Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Yeah. So, but I know plenty of Christians. I was working at a Catholic hospital, and I'm not Catholic at all, but like I see Catholic, good Catholics and stuff like that. So like, but when it comes to music, I instantly like, if I'm like, oh, this seems kind of interesting. Oh, wait a minute, they're a Christian band. It's like, ah, never mind then. So I have that in me, and I think it's because I like my music to have an edge to it.
Yeah.
And and that's a bias I have. That just,
well, no, there are some, I would imagine this applies to other religions as well. Like there are some Christian bands that I would, Five Iron Frenzy is one. They're like a punk ska band that I loved growing up, and their messaging, their beliefs, their sort of foundation in terms of what is pretty much where I'm at. Yeah. And they are a very accepting, inclusive group. Like they're not, they love anybody and everybody. Well, their drummer is now an atheist. When he started out, he was, you know, part of their youth group or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he said like, there's no way I'd stay in this band if they weren't the way that they are.
Yeah. Right.
And they're not pieces of shit. Yeah, they're not. Yeah. These Christians that give all Christians a bad name. So I think that there are some bands and probably that they still have it, but especially, I mean, I can speak from Christianity's perspective. There's no room for questioning in most cases. Mm-hmm. So having a band that's going to, like, one of my favorite Christian bands is Stryper. And a big reason I love Stryper is because in the 80s, they did not give a fuck about what any other Christian organization, church, whatever, were thinking. And they were, you know, by and large, pretty much shunned by the Christian community because of it. And they were super Christian. Like they had all these, but they wore yellow and black spandex, and they were hair metal dudes. Mm-hmm. And the Christian community, especially at the time, just had no idea how to even, because that just meant Satan. That meant Kiss. That meant, you know, all these sort of things. And so not having, you have to look for the friend, and more that's kind of how I've evolved in terms of like my spirituality and faith or whatever else is, I'm always kind of on the fringes of it. And the people that I connect with and relate to are people that maybe still have a pretty serious, sense of faith or spirituality or whatever else. Mm-hmm. But I mean, my mother of my kid is lesbian. Like I am so supportive of her and will be for the rest of my life. And I'm not taking my kid to any church that's going to tell him his mom's going to hell.
Right,
so
right.
That immediately sets me in a different category from a lot of Christians who, you know, view it. And I don't think it's a sin. I'm not there.
Right.
So that I think is harder because you have to go into areas where, it's not going to be promoted by most Christian, which sucks. Yeah. Not that I have a big stance on Christian music here. I think that's probably the case for any other religion or any other place like that. If there's a lot of rules and a lot of legalism and a lot of boxes and everything else, like it can make for some great art, but it's people that are going to be, not necessarily rebelling, but pushing against that and reacting to that and pointing out stuff like hypocrisy and all the horrific shit that comes out of religion, which, you know, churches don't want to talk about.
Right. Yeah.
You get on a soapbox.
Yeah, I know. Right. As we were winding down. Yeah. No, that was me for bringing it up. But I just thought when I read that title to your Spotify list, I was like, that's so hideous energy. all right, guys. Any you guys, want to promote anything? I know that Eerie International, it's a horror podcast that David does with Andy Preller and Dave Roberts and Austin. You're still a writing machine, putting stuff out. Is there anything you want to promote?
My podcast, whenever I record an episode,
Ledger.
Ledger. I've got an interview coming out here pretty soon with a writer named Brian Allen Carr. His book is called Bad Foundations, out from Clash Books. So you can check out my interview with him. You can just go to AustinRWilson.com and find every episode, but Ledger is also on every podcast platform, Spotify, Google, Amazon, Apple, all those. So
and you've
check
got
those things out.
You've got a lot of your works on your website as well.
Yeah, there's a bunch of free stuff on my website you can read. My most recent story is called Men's Rights Activists Resurrect Charles Bronson, and it is at a website called Defenestration. Oh, I think it's nice. Defenestration.net. It's making fun of men's rights activists for anyone who maybe hears the title and raises an eyebrow. Yeah, that's my most recent story that's gotten published, and I just write and submit and see what sticks.
Cool, cool. David, I did this past year help support Stone Cop, the comic book.
Oh, and, nice.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was a fun book. Yeah, it was fun, a fun book. The writer and the artist, I think the artist was involved. I only say that because I ended up winning a piece of artwork from helping promote it. And I got like a 11x14 piece of artwork, the original art that winning from helping support that. And so, yeah, man, thanks again, guys. I plenty of years listening to you guys talk about comics and all kinds of other stuff, pop culture stuff that I've really enjoyed. And I'm glad. You guys, I'm glad I got to meet you guys and have you guys on. And
likewise, man.
So yeah, we appreciate it.
Yeah. So
I will say right now, our current new creative outlet is playing The Finals on PlayStation 5. we've been playing a lot of The Finals here lately. That's obviously a joke. We have been playing, but great game. We've been enjoying. Austin, do you think we should kind of hint maybe?
Yeah, at something else? I was about to without even asking you.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead. You do it.
We do have a new show that we're currently working on, which makes it seem like we're doing work and we're not. If you've listened to Hideous Energy, you'll know that we're working on a thing means we have an idea and it's going to turn into something at some point. We do have a title. We won't reveal it quite yet.
Yeah, save the title.
It is it is real fucking stupid.
Yeah, we can reveal that the title was something I said as a joke to Austin. Like that it obviously wouldn't be this. That's stupid. And he was like, that's the name of the show. So the really dopey, stupid side of Hideous Energy will live on in that. But
yeah,
it'll be different. It'll be different than it won't be. I don't think either of us have the interest nor the willingness to risk talking about comics the way we used to anymore.
Yeah, that we
work in it, obviously it's so different, but there will be definitely the aspect that people, the thing that surprised us over the years is we had a lot of people that would tune in and listen and subscribe and love the show who did not give a fuck about comics, that just were listening just because they liked hearing us argue or talk shit or whatever, make fun of each other. So that will be more, I think, of the focus. It'll be kind of more of a whatever we want to do, whatever we want to talk about sort of thing. But then also, like, we talked a lot about how it's I just turned 35 a couple weeks ago. Austin's getting ready to turn 40. Like, we're older now. Mm-hmm. And when we started at Hideous Energy, I was 20, which is crazy to think now. So, it'll be a different vibe, but.
Yeah. I think also what we did was come up with an idea that will allow us to prepare even less than we prepared for episodes for Hideous Energy. So
that was the other big thing, was like, I've got a kid and Austin's married now. And like, there's been all these, you know, huge changes and jobs and careers and I'm divorced, like all this crazy stuff. So having something that, you know, we could just drop in and have fun and record and do something as opposed to having to prepare a ton. But I think also, you know, stuff that we are just into will end up, like, if you know, we've both been reading, we both recently read a lot of Adrian Tchaikovsky sci-fi books. And so, like, if the show were going on right now, you better believe there'd be like three episodes about Adrian Tchaikovsky. So I think it'll be stuff like that.
No, be a lot. I think you guys have because when I remember listening to Hideous Energy, you guys did the whole thing on Metal Gear Solid. I don't have any kind of connection to Metal Gear Solid.
I have no memory of that.
But,
I don't either.
But it was so I was right there with you guys, man, on the adventure.
I believe you. That's my favorite video game series of all time. Yeah. So I'm sure we did, but I don't remember.
Yeah. So go ahead, Austin.
Well, we're excited for
So that's for, awesome. Yeah,
when we start the new thing, it'll be fun. It's not a ton of concrete plans for when it's going to be yet, but at some point.
Yeah, the whole making it easy enough to that's what I've been doing with Mind Grenade since the beginning is like, I want to make it as streamlined as possible, and I don't want it to feel like homework.
And that's important.
Yeah. So, but still trying to take it seriously enough, you know, it's a balance for sure.
Last thing I'll say, and I only bring this up because this is such a massive lesson I've learned in the past couple of years, and one we've talked about over on Eerie a lot too. I know one thing, Austin, I haven't even talked about this, but I know one thing we both agree on is, if we need a break or if we need to rest, we're not going to record. it's not going to be a thing where we're like, well, we have to put an episode out this week.
Which, like, you guys were doing with Hideous Energy. It seems
we used to, and that was always fine. I don't think it ever stressed us out or like, but we had a lot more energy, no pun intended. We had a lot more time. So there were
younger and had lives that were wide open.
And it was a lot more simple. So especially now, like, you know, whether it's mental health stuff or personal stuff, like just taking a break if we need to is so important. And so I bring that up mainly for anybody listening to try to learn that lesson as quickly as you can. It's not laziness. It's not, you know, you know, just not wanting to do something. You can tell the difference between that and procrastination and laziness and letting your body and mind rest, only enhances and makes better work. So
I think we just solved all the problems in the universe, like right with this
Welcome, everyone.
Yeah. Also, fuck organized religion. Let's get back onto that.
Yeah, let's get more of that, right? Yeah. All right, guys. Awesome, man. You guys are the best. I love you guys. We'll call it an episode for all things Mind Grenade, like a feed of the podcast. My art gallery, they can all be found at mindgrenadestudios.com. So thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. This has been Hector for Austin and David saying so long, and we'll talk to you soon.